But I would walk 500 miles, and I would walk 500 more, just to be the man who walked 1,000 miles to fall down at your door. But I would walk 500 miles, and I would walk 500 more, just to be
Welcome to the Earth Favorite Band Podcast. It's 2017, which means it's a new year, a new you, and a new podcast, and a new guest host, apparently. This is usually the point in the show where I say, I'm Brandon, and I'm being joined with my best friend, Dave. That's usually a lie. Dave's not my best friend. And today I can say it truthfully that I'm here with my best friend, Cam. Cam, how are you?
Man, I'm doing great.
Good.
It's a lot better now that I know I'm your best friend.
Well,
sorry, Dave.
Listen, it's no knock on Dave. It's mainly just he's not very good at being, I don't know, excited about podcasting.
Well, I'm so excited.
Thanks.
That may be the only thing I bring to the table is that I'm excited.
Yeah. No, you're going to do great. A couple of exciting things. I wonder what Dave's doing. Dave is in Colorado right now, which is why he couldn't join us. He's on some ski trip. I wonder if I called him if he would answer. That'd be funny. I'm going to call him. I texted him just a little while ago. He didn't answer, so that might be. Let's see. Dave?
Oh, we got the old FaceTime. It's better than a call.
Well. Hello? Nope. Dave? This is exactly why I got a new co-host. See, he's not even going to answer. He's on the ski slopes.
Whoa.
Dave! Hey!
Why don't you do the video?
Oh, okay. We're doing video now. Dave?
Yeah.
Hey, buddy.
See it?
Yeah. I'm recording the intro to the Your Favorite Band podcast, and I thought I would call you. How you doing?
Just, you know, in the Rocky Mountains.
Yeah. I didn't know if you wanted to say anything to our listeners.
Oh, you're recording it right now?
Yeah, we're going to interview Sleeping at Last.
Cool. All right. Hey, everyone.
It's really nice. Do you miss them? Or, like, I mean, yeah?
There's a lot of missing going on here.
Yeah. Well, we miss you too. I was telling the listeners that I usually say that you're my best friend, and today I can actually mean it because Cam's here. You see what I did?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I do love you, and I hope you have fun.
Hey, I wanted to say good job on the next one. Hey, also, can we get the Goo Goo Dolls?
Sure, I'll get right on that, buddy.
All right.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Bye, bud.
Bye. And that's Dave. Good as ever. And I guess we'll go get the Goo Goo Dolls. You remember the Goo Goo Dolls?
Yeah, but I can't say that I listen to them a whole lot.
Okay. Well, what can you do? A couple of things real quick. One, Cam is my old roommate. Before him and I got married to women, we shared an apartment together. A duplex, just a real crapper.
Yeah.
Oh, we had this landlord named Gene. Gene was the worst.
Yeah.
Like, and
the
he was
best worst.
Right, but he was one of those.
Great guy.
He was the type of guy who, like, you'd call him and he'd be like, "Oh, hey, Brandon, how you doing?" Like, he'd act like he's excited to talk to you, and then you would ask him to do literally anything, and be like, "No, can't do that."
The most excited to see you, though. Every time he saw you or heard from you, just wouldn't do anything.
But then, you weren't allowed to send a check, right? Like, you had to hand deliver the rent on every month. And, like, we lived in this crappy house with everything that was could have been wrong with it. And then we would go to his place, and it's just like this big old, like, nice house with trimmed lawn. And he was old too, but he had a kid, which I still didn't.
Well. I don't know.
Listen, not saying that you can't do that, but just that sometimes it's hard. Anywho, Cam, real quick.
Yeah.
We were going to, when I set up this interview with Sleeping at Last, I found out that Dave was going to be gone. And the first person I thought of who could join me was you.
Wow.
Yeah. I know you're a big Sleeping at Last fan.
Huge.
Tell everyone why are you such a huge Sleeping at Last fan? And also, how do you feel about Trump?
Wow. We don't have time.
Particularly in that order.
I think maybe I'll only answer the first question for brevity's sake. I don't really know why I'm a huge Sleeping at Last fan. I just am. Can you know that? Like, you don't really, you can't, if you're a huge fan of something, you can't really put your finger on exactly why. You just are.
Sure you can.
No.
Sure you can. I can.
Okay. Why are you such a huge Sleeping at Last fan?
I'm a huge Sleeping at Last fan because his voice is the type of voice, like, so usually I can't listen to music with words while I'm working.
Yeah.
But there's something about his voice.
Yeah, you get like lost
just,
in it a little bit.
It just sinks into the flow of the song and the instrumentation and the melodies. And it just works. It's his voice is his own instrument.
Yeah.
So
no, you're right.
It works as instrumental, but it's not. That's why I like it.
Okay. I would say mine is similar. Yeah. I guess maybe I just don't think about these things as much as you. I would have said like the thing that I love the most about Sleeping at Last and the reason I'm so drawn to it is it's, without sounding too lame, it's just beautiful music. Like there's music that you enjoy for different reasons. I love listening to Sleeping at Last because it's just beautiful. And I think it takes me to different places and, you know, when I'm listening to it. And so I do, in a sense, get lost in it. I can work to it. I can study with it in the background. And it's just, yeah, I think I'd say it's beautiful.
I will say this. I tweeted out about a few minutes ago for questions. So we're interviewing Sleeping at Last in a few minutes. Mm-hmm. Do you have any questions? And Ryan retweeted it. And we're getting questions in from people that obviously have never listened to our podcast, but are huge Sleeping at Last fans. And just like, just some funny questions. Like, just
what are
like
some of the questions?
Well, just like, what was the first one that I saw that maybe be like, oh, that's not. Oh, here's this one. Have you always wanted to be my favorite singer? That's a great question.
Yeah.
Well, maybe we'll ask him. We'll ask him. But anyways, one second before we get into the interview, one thing. If you've ever listened to our podcast and thought, boy, I wish that they were better as far as like overall quality and stuff, we have also thought about that. We want to be better and get better. And another thing we want to do this year is we want to maybe buy some ad space through the Facebooks and stuff like that, so more people, fans of different artists, can hear their favorite band. That's the whole idea. So the way that we can do that is by the monies. So the first thing we want to do is improve some of our audio quality. And the second thing we want to do is buy some ad space. In order to do those two things this year, we need some money. So we launched a something that a lot of podcasts do, and it's going to get lost in the weeds. We get that. But if ours is a podcast that you listen to often and feel like we're doing a good thing, if you wouldn't mind going to our Patreon, I believe is the name of the website. It's in the description of our thing or on our website, yourfavoritebandpodcast.com. And you can give monthly, even as low as $1. And there's different like rewards. You get kind of like a Kickstarter. So you can get anything from access to a private Facebook group that you can talk about things and give ideas for questions and interviewees and stuff like that. We'll also start streaming the interviews live as they happen for people who give, I don't remember how much. And then there's also going to be an opportunity for you to interview your favorite band. So we'll put who we're interviewing on the page. And then if one person can say, I want to jump in on that interview. I don't remember how much that is month, but anyways, wow. If you like this podcast and like what we do, and want to give above your normal tithes and offerings, that'd be really great. You can do that and we'd really appreciate it. We want to keep pushing stuff out. We want to go weekly if we can. And all of that will make it a little bit easier. So please think about it. If you like what we do and want us to get better at what we do, that'd be really nice. All right, let's get to it. Are you ready? Are you ready?
Couldn't
are
be
you
more
ready?
Ready.
Are you ready?
I couldn't be more ready.
Okay. We are so excited to introduce our guest this week. This is one of those artists that we've talked about in the past in other episodes about how much we love their music, especially in the Christmas episode. We were talking about how much we love Snow and other songs like that. So, so excited to talk to Ryan from Sleeping At Last. Welcome to the Your Favorite Band Bot podcast.
Thank you so much. Great to speak with you guys.
Absolutely. Now, I know that you're a big fan of the podcast, naturally, so you know how we work. But for those of you that of course have never heard an episode of Your Favorite Band, we talk about a band, their entire life, their discography, and try to understand exactly what makes a band a band, and especially if somebody's your favorite band, how did they get to the point to where they're writing some of their favorite, your favorite music out there? So a lot of people like Sleeping At Last, and we're going to get to the bottom as to why exactly that is.
That's great.
Ryan, take us back to 1999, if you don't mind. You and I think your brother and another guy originally formed this thing that is called Sleeping At Last. So talk about why you guys started a band and the style that you guys were going for initially and what inspired you guys as far as songwriting and wanting to start a band.
Yeah. Also, how old were you?
Yeah. So in 1999, I'm 32 now, 33 actually. I have to verify that. But
who's counting?
So back then I probably would have been, I mean, I'm not great at math, so we'll figure that out. But I would assume probably 16-ish.
Okay.
And so my brother, as you mentioned, Chad was the drummer, and then my good friend Dan was piano and bass. So I started actually. I'll rewind a little bit. I started when I was about 13 or 14 years old, and I got my first guitar. My parents were kind enough to give me one for Christmas after a full year of me begging for one. Originally, I just wanted.
What guitar did you get?
It was an Epiphone, looked like a Stratocaster ripoff, but it was nice. Funny because it was such a cheap guitar that I think it was just called an Epi, so it couldn't even warrant the phone part.
That's great. My first electric was an Epiphone.
Oh, right? Nice. It's a great starting point.
It's a great starter.
So I fell in love with after about 2 or 3 months of playing it, I fell in love with the instrument, and then shortly after I fell in love with songwriting. So naturally it led to starting a couple local bands, and then that brought us to 1999, where I named my music Sleeping At Last, and then my brother and Dan were a part of it early on, and it was the start. I've had that name for quite a while, as you have pointed out.
Yeah. So you mentioned that you were in a couple of other local bands. Mm-hmm. So stylistically and stuff, how do those first initial projects, if you will, compare to Sleeping At Last, at least the early on projects of Sleeping At Last?
All extremely embarrassing. I was listening to a lot of alternative rock, and I still actually have some of that influence deep in there. And so I loved a lot of the music, but a lot of the music was stuff that now that I'm not as big of a fan of. But yeah, so it was definitely a little grunge in there. My mm-hmm. voice was completely opposite. I was trying to figure out what. I actually started singing about 2 years after I started playing guitars. It was more of a based out of necessity. We're like, all right, cool. Who's going to be the singer of the band? And
right.
I was just like, well, I guess I write the song, so I'll sing it. and then I tried to have this really gravelly voice from a 15-year-old or 14-year-old, and right. Wasn't working.
Started
wasn't
smoking
working so great.
Just to help, or?
Yeah, it sounded like it, but no. and so that eventually brought me to discovering bands that I felt incredibly inspired by, which was Radiohead and Bjork and. I'm trying to think, Sunny Day Real Estate, Smashing Pumpkins, and that brought mm-hmm. me to appreciate melody far more than the genre itself, and mm-hmm. and also the craft of songwriting. And Nick Drake was another influence of mine. So that, around that time is when Sleeping At Last formed, and then I think that was kind of the beginning of me finding my voice and finding the voice of the band and kind of what we wanted to do.
Yeah. So the first album that I ever heard of y'all's was Ghosts. Mm-hmm. And I know that the sound of that, but I haven't actually heard Capture, which y'all wrote and released prior to that.
Yeah.
What was that sound like? So, and why can't we find it anymore?
So Capture, it's similar to the most embarrassing photograph that you have of yourself. You're not going to necessarily post it on your Facebook. That's sort of the same thing. Capture was so hugely formative for me as a songwriter and for the band and for just the, it was the very beginning. It was where I said before that, like, me trying to figure out my voice, that was where I was trying to figure out how I recorded my voice, which is a totally different animal. And same thing, like, how do we go from taking like a live show that's very loud and drum heavy? And at that point, I mean, we've never been a really hard rock band, but it had some rock elements. And so how do you fit that into headphones? You know, how do you fit that into small speakers? So Capture was, a major education for us. And I think that that's, we just, when it went out of print, we were fine with that.
But surely it couldn't have been that bad.
It's not bad. I'm for the ages that we were, I'm very proud of it not being the worst thing I've ever heard in the world, but, it's not great.
Yeah.
Right.
And wasn't that a pretty big catalyst to y'all getting signed by Interscope?
Yeah, it was. So that was the beginning. So that record led to me meeting Billy Corgan from the Smashing Pumpkins. We gave that to him and we said, hey, we ran into him at a show downtown Chicago that we were playing at, and he didn't even see us perform, but he was backstage, and we, you know, I kind of freaked out and wasn't sure if I should give him our CD or not. And he walked by and I just decided, okay, I'm gonna be brave and be the guy that, you know, throws my CD his way when he walks by. And he was super generous and kind. And then that led to working together for a couple of years. And he really took me and the guys under his wing and brought the attention of a couple record labels. So we did some showcases. So Capture definitely led to some really, really helpful validating points in my career.
That's so cool. And it's really cool that he would take time to listen to something that someone, like, because not, I'd imagine most bands don't listen to everything
absolutely.
That another.
It was
like, I'm sure you've gotten some real crap. Like, people send you stuff and like, oh, I really love you, I wrote stuff. And you listen to it and you're like, oh man, that's awful. And eventually you just like give up trying to listen. So it's really nice that he would listen to that.
Absolutely. And it blew my mind at the time. And then the older I get now, the more beautiful of a gesture that was of him to do. Like, I recognize that it was just, it's for somebody at that level in their career to even pay attention to what some kid was doing was a really, it, like I said, is a, in my moment of, you know, being a teenager writing songs at that point, having kind of like a hero of yours say, hey, what you're doing has value, it was so validating. And I think it gave it, I still feel like my career has been built a little bit on that confidence from an early age, you know? So that was a huge gift, huge gift.
So to talk about a little bit about Interscope and being signed by Interscope, like, most bands dream about getting signed. So talk about that for you guys as like a younger band and finally like getting signed by this really big record label and how that kind of affected the writing and recording process for someone who's just starting to learn how to craft songs to being signed to this big label that kind of might try to control a little bit more of your craft.
Yeah, absolutely. Interscope was actually really, I mean, you hear all the nightmare stories of all these different major labels. And I think that at the time that we signed, this would have been 2001 or I think, sometime around then. It was kind of the last last few years of major labels giving artists an opportunity to develop without a developing deal or a development deal or any of that kind of stuff. And the deal was really fair, and it was, they gave us an incredible budget. They let us do what we wanted to make. Like, they believed in what we were going to do. So, it was again a really validating point. But I will say that making the record Ghost was one, I mean, creatively, definitely one of them. It was the most challenging period of my life so far, because it was almost so much freedom that it it kind of wrecked my brain a little bit. You know, I was this kid that had only recorded in his friend's house for, that's the only example I have of making music on a record. And I felt like this was my, you know, my dream come true to sign with a major label. And we had all the time in the world, all the resources in the world to make exactly what I wanted to make. And as wonderful as that was, there were some outside factors that were very stressful too. There was some relationship stuff that was going on. There was some very, I always say that it was my introductory into adulthood. And dealing with all that at the same time, I got so stressed out at one point of making the record that my voice completely just left. Like my singing voice was gone for a good 2 months where I tried everything to try to get it back. And, it was all just stress related. I was so, filled with anxiety. And so it's interesting to me because that was where I said that Capture sort of was it was very much a lesson in finding our voice. Ghost was sort of the trial by fire, like more pressure. I mean, all the pressure was internal. It was all me pushing myself to be like, this is my one shot. I have to make this the best I possibly can make this record. I have to put everything I have. I mean, it was the first time I ever wrote string arrangements. It was the first time that I ever co-produced anything. It was the first time. There was so many firsts. It was even the first, example we had of working with Pro Tools, because before that there were Pro Tools was a much more expensive machine to, you know, we were recording at a friend's house who had like a digital I can't remember what we recorded to, but it was not Pro Tools, didn't have the editing, so it was almost like it was being set free and like being the king of some town that you've never been to. Sort of like, we can do anything. I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm terrified. So I put a lot of pressure on myself. Eventually the record got made. We got to, had some really incredible experiences. We got to fly to London where it was mixed for a good month and a half. Like it's funny now looking back. Cause the way that money was spent and the way that records were made in that time, which is, you know, not that long ago, is so different. And especially with my career as it is now as a solo artist and as an independent artist for the past decade, it literally is the exact opposite. Like there's very little overhead in recording my music now. Whereas before it was dumb money being spent. It was just like, hey, we need to mix our record in London. Well, we're not even mixing it, but I'm going to be in London for 2 months. Like there's like stuff that's money being spent. That was just like, that's just how you did it. And that's, we were encouraged to do it that way and, had a very healthy budget to work with. So it was, like I said, trial by fire in the way that we had every resource available to us, and this is the record that we were going to try to make, and it ended up being the most directional point in my career in terms of like it taught me how to produce music, and I've carried that with me I will be carrying that with me until I die. You know, I will continue making music. Everything I've done since has been as a result of those lessons in that recording process.
What was the landscape of Interscope during that time? Because now, I mean, so much of the label is with like hip hop artists, you know, Kendrick Lamar and J. Cole and all of these guys. Like, what was it like back then?
Yeah, so our A&R, who's great, he was the A&R for No Doubt and Gwen Stefani and U2. I think they signed to Interscope right around that time. So it was right before we signed a deal with them. And so we knew that we were teeny tiny artists in a very large ocean of talent. And so I think the unfortunate thing that happened with our record was right around the time the record was done. There was some, I think Geffen, either, I can't remember who bought who, but there was a lot of mergers going on with record labels. Mm. And, so the people that were originally set out to promote our record and had like kind of these campaigns lined up for the record, they just got moved into totally different jobs. So we had new people coming in. And so we kind of got lost in the shuffle when the record actually came out. But
how did it sell?
It sold okay. I think actually pretty well at that time. There were some opportunities, like our friend Switchfoot took us on tour, and that was our first US tour. And so that was a really huge opportunity for us to kind of kind of understand what a tour looks like in that capacity. And then we toured extensively after that, and there were some opportunities kind of that came as a result of releasing the record. But it was, you know, I think that the original plan with Interscope was a very different campaign and a different outcome. So though it was a great success for us, and I think the label had just changed so much by the time the record came out that there was, you know, a lot of artists kind of got lost in the shuffle, and we were one of them. And then eventually that led to kind of deciding like, hey, I think it's going to be best to be an independent. And
talk about that a little bit. 'Cause most bands at least signed for a couple of albums. So you just did the one and done type thing. Was that a part of the contract, or were you just,
yeah, it was, which
mutual
was,
or what?
Which was awesome. I mean, it's a little bit like ending a relationship that, you know, you should end, but it's kind of sad anyway.
Yeah.
'Cause again, part of it was, you know, having a record label was sort of a childhood dream come true. And after we had done it and kind of realized like, all right, you know, like down to the simple things, like we would need a tour poster. And I always enjoyed designing, and so did Dan. And so we would put together these designs, but to get a tour poster made with a record label, it was like, it had to go through a circus of 10 different people. And then, you know, months later, yeah, it's too late. So we're like, right, we could have just gone to, you know, Kinko's, or we could have had this printed. And so I think we realized very quickly, when the record came out, that like, especially for me, like I love being hands-on in the career. I love the business of it. I love the producing and I just really enjoy every aspect of it. So it came time, I think our manager, recommended that we, you know, maybe we don't look for another label, because there was a couple other offers, there was a couple other people interested, and then we just decided like, let's try the independent road. And we were by no means like the first band to, you know, be independent, but it was not very common as it is today.
Yeah, I mean, that was still early on.
Yeah, still very early on. Like
music was still selling at that point, right?
Absolutely, music was still a thing that made money.
Yeah. And,
I mean, it does now too, but that's silly to say. But it was such a different landscape. Like at that point there was no. It was very hard to even get your music. Like iTunes was just becoming a thing. And so it was very hard to find digital distribution. That was a whole new planet. 'Cause it was always like, that was the main reason you signed with a record label, is so that your music could get the exposure that you would want it to have. So it could be sold in Target, and it could be sold in whatever stores were, you know, record stores across the country or the world. And shortly after we left the label, I can't remember the exact timelines of when iTunes opened up and when some different online distributors became kind of more the norm. It was really kind of beautifully timed, like where the exposure to our music, we could kind of build off of what we built on the with Interscope, and then we had a very kind and loyal fan base, and then we made our own, the next record, Keep No Score, and that was our first independent record, which was made for like, you know, a fraction of the cost of of Ghost.
Right.
And really like enjoyed that process, kind of letting ourselves, first of all, producing it, and also like letting there be, the only pressure we allowed being in the studio was just our own. We didn't have to report to anybody. We didn't have to, so we, that kind of set the course for like, I love being independent. This is awesome.
Keep No Score a little bit. I was listening back to some of it today, and I can kind of hear a little bit more of an orchestral feel than in Ghost. And that sound is kind of growing into who you are now. But talk a little bit about how your sound and your songwriting was evolving at that point as you were getting ready to write this new independent album, Keep No Score.
Yeah, absolutely. So where Ghost had some like more like, dynamic alternative music where there's lots of quiet bits, and then all of a sudden it has a lot of big guitars and halftime drums and things like that. I think the stuff that I was listening to around the time in between that record and Keep No Score led me down a path of really appreciating more organic instrumentation. So even though there was still electric guitars and drums and things like that, I enjoyed so much writing strings for Ghosts and using like a real string players and going down that route, that for Keep No Score, I knew right away that like, oh, I want this to be more cinematic. So even though it's in retrospect, it's not nearly as cinematic as some of the music that I've made since, but, in terms of style and in terms of strings and orchestral, I was becoming more and more interested in, softer songs and more intimate writing, and so that kind of shaped what we wanted to do with that record, and then that led to Storyboards, which came out a couple years later. And at that point, my brother had decided to move on to some other things, so it was just me and Dan. And that record was my wife gave me a ukulele for my birthday, and I've totally fell in love with that ukulele, and I ended up writing I think at least two-thirds of the songs on just my ukulele, so that kind of brought it into a different direction. And I'll let you ask another question before I tell you the whole career path here.
I think for me, like, as I listen to y'all's discography, I see more similarity between Ghosts and Keep No Score, but then when Storyboard comes, and then really the albums or the records since then all seem to have the more consistency with them being more orchestral and in nature and more intimate, I guess. Yeah. But at the same time, as I listen to your music, like if anyone were to play a Sleeping at Last song, I would know instantly, yeah, this is Sleeping at Last.
Oh, cool.
There's something unique about it that I think in a sense distinguishes it from other music. And at the same time, you've continued to evolve your sound in new directions. And that's something I've always found interesting. I'm not a musician myself, so I don't really even know like how to phrase this question, but
no, it's great.
Essentially, like, a lot of bands I'll see, you know, they have a similar sound and then they change their sound. And I know that like an example would maybe be Mumford and Sons.
Yeah.
They come out with this new record and everybody knows it's a different sound, and some people like it and some people hate it. But for you, we see like an evolution of that sound and a progression, and it's different, but at the same time there's still this like unique consistency that's Sleeping at Last. How do you do that?
That's super cool. Thank you for saying that. So I definitely, yeah, I think there's never been any like change in my sound has always just been an organic, like I just fell in love with a specific type of music that influenced it more heavily. And I think that I've always kind of liked the same thing. Like, so when I was really young, even before I wrote songs or played guitar, I would listen to, you know, my whatever records or a song on a movie would come up, and I would like, the hair on my arms would stand up. It would give me goosebumps. And usually it was a ballad or some emotional song. And I kind of became obsessed with that feeling and that idea that like, wow, like a piece of music or sound could give people an emotional and physical feedback. And I just love that music has the power to move people in that way, because it really does. There's something really special about that. And so I think I've always aimed to try to make music that would do that, at least for me. And you know, it's hard, because mostly songwriting is a lot of hard work, but it starts somewhere. And I feel like that's sort of been my rule with writing songs, is like, I won't continue working on it unless at some point it gave me that feeling. And so maybe that has something to do with a lot of consistency. But also, as I get older, I think I just am more confident in what I like, for better or worse.
Yeah.
You start listening to the same bands you used to listen to rather than being hungry for all the new stuff that's coming out. I still love keeping in touch with what's actually happening. But I do find myself like going back to music that I was really inspired by over the, you know, several years earlier.
Yeah. Was there ever a thought in your mind, especially after your brother left, and even more so when it became just you, to switch it up and do something that's not under that Sleeping at Last umbrella, since it is a little bit different musically, your first couple of albums versus the rest of your discography? Was there ever this idea of, all right, I'm solo now, I'm going to put it under my own name or a different name rather than Sleeping at Last? Or how did you decide to do that?
Yeah, so I've always written the songs, and I've always had the approach of writing the songs really, really personally, and more like almost like a page out of my journal. Each song kind of became that. And so because they're such personal songs, I felt like I assigned the name Sleeping at Last to those personal songs. So even though the shape of the band has changed and the sound has changed over the years, it still felt like I'm not actually looking to try to start a new thing. Like I'm continuing to write in that same journal. So I should leave stick with the name, if that makes sense.
So going back to storyboard, and you continuing to hear more and more these orchestra parts and just elaborate compositions, and you even collaborated with Van Dyke Park, who's just done so many different things with so many different artists. And how are you personally growing in your composing knowledge? Like for me, like I'm very limited in my musical abilities. I know my limits, and I know that I can grow, but I wouldn't even know where to start when it comes to composing these orchestra parts. So how did you say, I want to learn this and I want to grow in this and just continue to grow to the point now where it's like just a part of who you are as a musician is like these amazing backing orchestra parts?
Yeah, man, thank you for saying that. I would say, like, so it's funny, I actually can't read and write sheet music, which I probably should be ashamed to admit that. But so everything that I write is just based on like how it looks on the piano or how it looks on the guitar. So even when I'm writing things, I actually don't even pay attention to what chords I'm playing. And sometimes that's super limiting, and other times it's really, really freeing, because I can put a capo on my guitar and write something and be like, oh my gosh, this feels new to me. And even though it'll be like a G and a, you know, whatever standard chord, but it looks different and it feels new. So it's almost a little bit of a mind trick. And so how I approach like the orchestral end of my writing is, a lot of the times I'll write out like just with like synth strings and things like that. Like I'll start with the cello, and there's definitely some, I had to learn a lot as far as like, all right, what is the cello capable of? Like what range do you write in? You know, like what, how does that actually work with a viola? How does that, like, what are the traditional methods, and what are kind of some fun ways to write differently with those instrumentation or with those instruments? And So I had to stumble my way through a lot of it. And then there's times where, like you said, where I enlist the help of like Van Dyke Parks, who wrote this incredible, crazy arrangement to a song that I wrote just on top of it. And so then it was a matter of producing that over the song that I had written. And so that's another way that I have learned a lot and have seen some really interesting ways of approaching music. But yeah, so I definitely try to continue to, like I don't think I ever want to get to the point where I'm not stretching pretty far outside of my comfort zone of writing. Even though I like what I like, I definitely I constantly want to push myself to, so the projects I'm working on right now, it's called Atlas, and it's an ongoing series of song releases that follow some real specific themes. And what I love about it is like these themes that I'm coming up with, they're really, really helpful in like creative limitations. So I will, for example, I did an album of songs that were, written for each of the songs or each of the planets in our solar system. And so learning about Mercury, like I did a bunch of different, you know, research on each of the planets and learning more about Mercury and the core being liquid metal. And I was just like, oh man, that would be really fun to like try to write try to write with only metallic instruments. So then I set that rule out, and then I have to write in only in that range. So that those kinds of like creative challenges really do stretch me and help me think about things differently. And so that's kind of how I keep pushing myself a little bit.
Yeah. That's so interesting. I was actually going to ask you about like creative restraints, because you kind of mentioned even, you know, when you guys got signed to Interscope, of having almost so much freedom that you didn't really know what to do with
it.
And I've heard that from various artists, you know, who use different mediums, that finding the right restraints can actually help kind of release this like newfound creativity that they can tap into because they've found the right restraints, not having no restrictions at all.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It is like one of the most helpful tricks into writing. Like actually before I started even doing the Atlas project, every once in a while I would find like a short film that I was inspired by, or even like a normal film. And I would try to write to the picture just to give me like an inspiration point. Like I'd mute the sound and just like try to write piano to like this scene that I really was moved by in a movie that I saw recently. And I would try that kind of stuff. And that would even provide like a limitation to like, all right, well this happy chord progression doesn't really make any sense over what's going on in the screen. And so that would limit to like the type of mood that the song would be written in. And I find the same thing with even like I've done a bit of scoring over the last couple of years of different films and short films and stuff. And that's one of my favorite things about it, is that it's like you get that instant feedback while you're watching something that you like, this works or doesn't work. So it's no longer about, is this good or not? It's because the first question is, does this work or not? Does it emotionally tell the same story? Does it? And then that kind of, then you can start working on, is this good or not? You know, but those creative limitations are super helpful.
Is that like a tactic that you use with writing lyrics as well? Like we had somebody who asked, I think through Twitter, how you get over writer's block or deal with writer's block, if you've ever dealt with that, as applying like these creative limitations. Does that help even with writing lyrics or?
Yeah, no, totally. So I sometimes put a little bit too many like creative limitations on my writing. Like I'll be in the middle of writing lyrics and I'll be like, all right, so I'm trying to think of a good example. Oh yeah. One example is on my project Yearbook. I really love movies, and I was writing this love song that was totally about my wife and about kind of like the vows that I wish I had written in our in our wedding. Hmm. And so the lyrics had that direction, and I was very confident that that's what I wanted the song to be about. But I also thought, I'm like, man, it'd be really fun. I just, you know, the year just ended, and I love movies, and so I made like a top 10 list of my favorite movies, and wouldn't it be cool in each of the verses to reference each of the top 10 movies, even though the song has nothing to do with movies whatsoever. So I'll put that limitation in. So every verse, like I can go back and be like, yeah, that mentions, you know, Exit Through the Gift Shop or Tangled or The King's Speech or Toy Story 3 or whatever came out that year. And, so I do often put those types of limitations on the lyrics as well. And it does that. Honestly, that actually probably makes it harder for lyric writing. Yeah. Lyrics should be at their best. They should be as personal and as, you know, the craft of writing lyrics is very difficult to just say it well, but they should also just start coming from an honest place. That's a hard enough limitation.
Yeah, for sure. On a side note, you're talking about movies. I did see on your website that you're watching West Wing right now. That might be old.
I'm brand new to West Wing over the last year.
I'm brand new. I was at a TV festival in Austin, and they did like a reunion.
Oh, cool.
And
that's awesome. It.
They did like this whole panel, and Sorkin was there and everything.
Cool.
And I was like, I gotta watch this show now, because I love Sorkin.
I get it. I saw now. The newsroom. It's great, right?
I saw the newsroom. I don't know if you've seen Newsroom, but you have to.
I have, yep.
And so that's what made me want to watch it. It's so good. We should start a podcast about it.
Yeah, totally.
But held in museum display, time pauses further away. And when we rebuild it, all of the details fade. Only silhouettes were made.
going, you mentioned the yearbook.
I was going to ask if you did three songs every month for a year. It's this mm-hmm. crazy idea. I was going to ask if it gave you a lot of pressure to write and compose these three songs every month, but it almost sounds like you put those restrictions on yourself on purpose, because you work well creatively that way. Was that why you did it? Because you were like, I'm going to put out three songs and that's going to force me to write about this and this. And it'll help me creatively.
I think the lessons of all of this have been learned since then. So like the genesis of
stumbled your way.
This is a little step back.
Yeah,
huh?
Yeah, exactly. So yearbook came out in 2010, 2011, I think. And like you said, it was three songs. I announced on my website that I'm gonna write and record three songs every month for a year. And so 36 songs later, the reason I decided to do that was I was kind of getting frustrated with the idea of like recording an album and then going away from it for 2 months or 2 years and then putting another record out. Like I felt like every time I would return to writing, it would just feel like this foreign thing that I don't know how to do. So I just thought, I'm like, okay, well, what do I love most about this career in music? And I kept coming back to the same thing. Like I love writing and recording. That is my absolute favorite part. I love live shows. It's a totally different thing. And I love that aspect as well. But if I had to choose, I would pick writing and recording. So I thought like, okay, I want to be a better writer. I'm going to try to challenge the system of making a record every few years and try to just see, like, you know, the only criteria that I laid out for myself was I just had to be proud of everything I put out. Like it didn't have to be, you know, this exact masterpiece that I was hoping each song would be from all the records before it. And I think I was starting to get the inkling that like, or have an inkling that my music, maybe I'm overthinking it. And I need to like get back to the true source of like, when I write a song, what is the heart of it? And putting like a creative limitation on like, okay, I have to write three songs every month. That gave me, it gave me a huge kick in the butt to push through any laziness, any confidence issues. And like, it really drove me. And the idea that I announced it first.
Yeah. Did you have the subscription thing going on for this one?
Yeah. So that was built, that was kind of born out of necessity. Cause I was like, all right, obviously these things will show up on iTunes and Spotify and everything else, but how will it, you know, it would be great. This is a lot of releases coming out. Like how can people that are interested in my music, like keep track of all of them? So the subscription model was sort of born out of that. And, but anyway, so I got, my theory was I'm either going to totally like crash and burn but the good side of it is I'll be a better songwriter for it, or I will make it through and I'll be a better songwriter for it. So it was a kind of a win-win situation for me. And, doing that project was so, so hard and so like it stretched every part of my creativity, my time, my relationships, like everything in a way that was really, really intense, but it taught me so much. And I feel like it showed me that like the music that I really serve in that way is more true to my soul and more true to my, like my heart. So being forced to create and let people hear it at that stage of just being like, okay, I just recorded this song and I'm going to put it out. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
that was such wonderful feedback. No.
Yeah, I was going to say, since it had to be so quick every month, are there any songs on that collection that you're just like, that song, like I wish that I had more time on it?
Are
there any songs that you're just like, that sucks?
I, at the risk of sounding arrogant, no. Like I actually and I don't make a habit of listening to my music ever. Once it's done, I feel like it's done. But there are times where I have to like listen to, you know, the test pressings of a record, and I have to go back and make sure it all sounds okay. But in the experience of having done that with every record that I've made, when I listen to Yearbook or Atlas, which were all made in, you know, in much faster and, you know, longer or not, sorry, faster and more concentrated moments of my creativity, those songs for sure 100% stand out to me as being like, I wouldn't do anything differently. They do exactly what I wanted them to do, and they capture whatever that original source was. Whereas like if I listen to Ghosts or if I listen to Keep No Score, I hear things that I would, that I feel like I overprocessed or I overthought, and I missed the mark of some of the, you know, understanding what the song was really about, or, and they're not necessarily regrets. They're sort of like, I would tweak those things for years. Whereas Yearbook and Atlas songs, I feel like I let them go exactly when they're ready to be let go.
Yeah, for sure. It's funny. I think I was still in high school, and I was just learning how to write songs and recording on Audacity. And, I did this same type of thing. I said, all right, I'm going to put 3 songs out every month.
That's
no
awesome.
One cared. Like no one cared. So I did it for a few months, and then I couldn't write another song. Cause I'm just like, I don't know what to write. And so I just stopped doing it. No one noticed.
It's draining. But, it is totally draining.
I was
draining.
Like, man, I wish I had this subscription model. Like the fact that people have paid and like, I feel like I have to do it.
Yeah,
then
no,
I probably would have finished.
That is literally the key to it. Cause if I had just said like I've tried personally doing that before many, many years ago, I would be like, all right, I'm going to write, you know, 1 song every week or whatever it is. And I would do it for the first week. And then as soon as I was like, nobody notices, it's fine.
Yeah, so hard.
I'm back to
will you
back
ever
to not
do
writing.
An album? Will you ever do an album again, like a normal traditional album? Or is
yeah,
this
probably.
Like kind of where
like
you're
I still I still love the romantic idea of like a full length record. I feel like it's. But I will say that so whereas Yearbook was the 3 songs every month for a year, the project I'm working on now, Atlas, is kind of it changes up that format every year I'm doing it. So I'm on the 2nd year right now, and so for example, last year was a series of EPs, but in the middle of that series for Atlas Year 1, I did a song for each of the planets called Space, and that actually forms a full length record. So it starts with the sun and kind of moves its way all the way to Pluto as like a bonus track. So I still get to play around with that format. So I wrote it with the idea that it is a single album, even though it's part of it's a piece of a whole other project, and it fits in the storytelling and all that of the whole concept of Atlas, but it was written as an album. So I still feel like I get to write albums in the middle of this project too, and I get to write singles, and I also get to write EPs, and so I kind of feel like the Atlas project for me in doing these series of songs, it gives me the freedom to kind of do all of that. But I think that if the right concept or the right time comes up in the next few years, I wouldn't be at all surprised to return back to doing a full length record. And then, you know, so I enjoy playing around with the idea of kind of whatever is fitting my creative whim right now.
I'll be brave when you are friend. You'll be strong. I'll be calm when you have had enough of these rushing waves. You'll be the oxygen I need, and we'll take turns.
So because you're kind of recording and releasing these things, you know, as you said, like once that song is ready to be released, like you release it and you let people hear it, people can kind of observe the timeline of your music based on what's going on in life, as opposed to, you know, some people, it may take them 2 or 3 years to write an album and then they release it all at once and you don't really know where they were when they were writing each of those songs and what they were processing through. But, you know, on Atlas, under the EP Darkness, somebody asked a question. I actually have the same question. I'm trying to remember Even the Odds. Is there a story behind that? Were you walking through, you know, something really difficult? Like what's the, I mean, those are some of the most beautiful lyrics that I've ever read in my life. So
thank you so much. So it is a fictional story, but there's a lot of my own story kind of woven into it. But so basically that EP Darkness, it had, it, it, it kind of, the idea is that it starts off with, I wanted to do basically five interpretations of what darkness could be. Not all negative. Mm-hmm. Like that song in particular was sorrow. Like it felt like very much like the like depression and the hardest thing you can imagine in life. So it was a fictional story that I wrote, but it was, there's some significant connections to what was going on in my life around that time. And, I lost a friend of mine that later that year, and he was sick for a while. And so there's things like that that influenced it, but that was a fictional story. And then other parts of darkness, like I meant, like one song, I'll Keep You Safe, is a story about a parent of somebody, of a child that lost his or her sight. So I like the idea of that interpretation of darkness. And then the other one is sort of about just the beginning song. It's called Overture. That song is supposed to represent like the unlimited possibilities that like lie in waiting in the darkness, you know? So it's a more positive angle on darkness. But, I can't remember if I've said this already, but so Atlas tells one overarching story over the course of several chapters, if that makes sense. So it's about the origins of the universe. So it starts with an EP called Darkness that basically is exactly that, where it's the unknown, completely unknown. And then another EP called Light, which is the beginning of all things. And then we get to my space songs, which is kind of bringing the metaphorical camera closer to us, and it's our solar system. And then an EP called Land, which is about Earth specifically. So there's a song for North, East, South, and West. And then the last EP on that year of Atlas is called Oceans, which represents our five oceans. And then that also connects to life, since we were kind of born out of water, you know? Yeah. So, yeah. And then year two is basically, again, bringing us closer and closer to us as the subject of my writing. And, it's all of the involuntary human development. So it goes through the five senses, the things that we're born with that we don't get to decide. And it goes through the four basic human emotions. And then right now I'm currently working on a thing called the Enneagram, which is basically this thought that, that there are nine different personality types that, that we as all people kind of fall into one of these types. And, and it's believed that by a lot of different people that teach it, that you're sort of born with your type. So that's how it fits into that. And then, so Atlas Year 3 will be about the voluntary human development. So the things that we do with all of those ingredients. So it'll be creativity, love, dreaming, all of that. So that's, it is, as you can see, like Atlas tells one overarching story, which is the origins of who we are.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm interested in kind of the tension you might feel as a songwriter to not just write the same thing over and over again. Like so you have this whole 36 songs in a year, or the Atlas project or whatever. You're writing about the same kind of themes, like love, faith, questions, and so on and so forth. But from different standpoints and different points of views, and from a 10,000 foot level to a close up level, how do you personally keep it fresh from not just writing the same exact thing, like, oh, I love you, over and over and over again? How do you keep it fresh personally?
Yeah, totally. It is probably the thing that I think the most about, where I really, you know, like I've gotten to the point now and over the last, because I'm writing and recording so much, that it used to be like when I was writing an album, I would accidentally stumble on like writing somebody else's song and realizing it halfway through and having to throw the whole thing out, you know, like, oh man, I knew that melody sounded familiar. And now I'm getting to the point where I'm accidentally like writing my song again. So I'm like, oh man, I like that. Oh wait, crap. That's totally my song like 2 years ago. So there's a lot of really like forcing me to reach for other instruments and other sounds to kind of continue to light or spark something new. And so I'm sure I'm guilty of accidentally having things that sound a little similar to other things. But I think that those themes, like especially in Atlas, I think the themes actually really, really help push forward like a new way of thinking about, even if it is a similar topic. And I always joke around that, like, so I get super into the conceptual end of that project and I talk about it all excited. And, but then I realize that like a lot of times people just want to know, like, oh yeah, they're just songs that that began with those themes. So they're just new songs about life and hope and death and family. And, you know, so if somebody's not interested in those topics, I hope that there's still a stepping stone into listening to these. They're just new songs.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I got Atlas on vinyl for Christmas.
Oh, cool. Thanks.
Three different colors.
That's awesome. What'd you get? What colors were in your,
I got, well,
if you remember, not that you would,
I asked for it and I got it from my parents, but then I also got it from my brother. They didn't talk about it.
And oh, that's awesome. So I got both of them.
And, so then I opened it up and I looked at the colors and I just picked the ones I want and then put the ones I didn't want as much and gave it to a buddy as a
present.
So it worked out great. So I got like, this nice like aqua blue, and then I got a dark blue, which is really pretty. And then this nice gold transparent.
Oh, that's cool. Sorry. It's a weird question to ask. What color records did you get? As if I don't know, but they are all completely random. So that's why I get excited to see. So I, on Instagram,
well, that's why it was fun. Like I got two, which normally I'd be like, oh, that's dumb.
Yeah.
But it allowed me to pick the colors that I wanted, which,
yeah, you know, absolutely,
it's a super like goofy thing to be excited about.
So the moral of that story is to buy multiple copies and then
pick your favorites. That's exactly
right. Yep, you heard anything.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, if you learn anything, please buy 7 albums.
Yeah. But thanks for making colorful vinyls.
That's, oh my gosh, I love it. It's story. That is actually one of the most fun parts of like finalizing the music and actually getting it pressed onto like a physical format like that. It's really, it's really fun, especially when the format happens to be like, you know, larger scale like that. And it's like, it's just really fun to fun process to go through.
So a lot of times I hear from different people, they can hear the same song, but, interpret it in different ways or feel emotions for different reasons. And for you, you write, you know, several songs around a particular subject, but from different vantage points. And I'm curious, is that part of the reason that, you know, TV shows or movies, they tend to be drawn to your music for their soundtracks, just because they can pull people, emotionally in different directions for various reasons?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not totally sure. I think that there might be, so as I mentioned earlier, I've always loved film and TV and I've always been kind of drawn to cinematic music. And so I do think that probably can, definitely, influence that I'm writing music that even though I'm not writing it for a specific, a lot of the times I'm not writing it for a specific TV show or film, but I just am so moved by the storytelling of film and TV that I'm sure that it comes through because of the sheer volume of music I listen or films and TV I watch. But yeah, I think that what you said about how people interpret the songs differently, I think that must play into it to some degree, at least. Cause I mean, for me, that's definitely like the magic of songwriting. Like when somebody can hear something that you wrote that has a very specific and, you know, maybe personal and a very intentional story or point, and somebody can take that and somehow it will light up some part of their brain that is completely opposite of how you meant, but somehow it means something to them. And I think actually all art can do that. And it's that is the magic of creativity in art. So I've always been aware of it and excited that is a possibility that I can write this very, you know, intensely personal piece of music and lyric that will be, that might speak to somebody in a completely different circumstance and from a completely different walk of life. And, so yeah, I get really excited about that. And I do wonder if like the film and TV placement, situation for me, if that plays into it at all or not.
Yeah.
That's a good question.
I mean, it's interesting. Like, you know, a lot of people will write about a particular experience that they've had, but a lot of times your music is written about different elements of our experiences. So like the darkness, for example, we can all have various experiences that all have these elements of darkness for various reasons.
Yeah.
So I assume that it reaches a pretty broad audience for that reason.
That's true. And I've become more direct in my songwriting like over the last couple of years, but those themes do sort of leave a lot of like abstract thought and abstract idea in it. But I do think that my like default position on like lyrics is that I tend to really like abstract thought and like poetry. Yeah. In lyric writing. So I do wonder if that plays into it at all too, where it's 'cause I just I'm always drawn to like words that don't necessarily always go together that like open up a little bit of a different creates, rabbit hole of thought.
Yeah, it kind of creates more room for interpretation.
Yeah, totally.
I have two thoughts before we go to the next question. One, I wish you had scored the West Wing because I don't know if you've noticed, they always use this like oboe. Like so the credits are great. The credits are like the opening title.
Thomas Newman.
Wonderful.
Yeah, opening title
but the
awesome.
Rest of the score, like I don't know what the oboe's doing and it just comes in at these random points and I'm just like, it kind of ruined some scenes for me. That's all. Second.
There are some serious oboe moments in the West.
So oboe. another thought that I had, you were talking about how you're writing a little bit more direct. That's one of the things that I appreciate about you. It'd be easy with the style of music that you create to be super artsy and kind of over the top in your metaphors. But the thing that I appreciate the most about you is I can listen to your lyrics and like get it, like, or at least get it from me. Like,
oh, awesome. No, that's
I don't
so
have
cool.
to over. So like, for instance, one of my favorite songs by you is Saturn because it, like the opening is so beautiful, but then lyrically it's so clear to me, at least for me, what you're trying to say there. And I love it and I appreciate it. And it'd be easy not to do that when you're talking about darkness and light and space and stuff like that to get too over the top and
too
metaphors.
Abstract.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, so. that's totally cool to hear. And, I think that, it is sort of, I don't think I've even put it together, but it is sort of, I'm realizing at this moment that I feel like probably my favorite type of lyric writing is when it is abstract in that it's like a creative thought, but at the same time, you're still telling a concise story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like you're still, there's still, like you can still follow it, it's just using language that doesn't necessarily tell it as traditionally as you might tell it.
Right.
You
know? Yep. One of the things that I noticed, and we've gotten a couple of questions, is that I think it's probably because of the writing and the recording schedule that you have, but you don't tour a lot anymore. You don't play many shows, which is a little bit odd for an artist because, like you said, you traditionally record an album, you go out for a couple of years, and then you're done with it. But in your case, you're constantly recording and constantly writing. So a couple of people want to know if you are planning on touring at all. One person, KV13, said, would you ever consider doing a live stream performance? So where are you at when it comes to playing these songs live? Because there is a lot going on there, so that also might be tough to do live as well.
Yeah, no, it's like I think that playing live and writing and recording music are like two separate muscles. Yeah. And so I have been continuing to exercise the writing and recording muscle, and the live muscle, it's still totally there. And I love performing and I love the idea of sharing these songs in that environment. I think it's really, really, really fun. And so I definitely will return to it. And I have a few ideas for some shows later this year, as well as maybe next year. We'll probably have a little bit more of an emphasis on that. And so I will definitely be playing more shows live. And the reason I haven't over the last few years is because I've just been so, so excited about these projects and the recording schedule just doesn't allow for me to serve either of those muscles well if I'm, you know, taking time off from recording to play live or vice versa.
Yeah. And one of the things I love, you have that live video of you doing Snow, which is one of my favorite winter songs. It's just a winter song.
That's so kind.
And you have that live shot and you ask the crowd to like kind of make that moaning noise, kind of that drone.
Yeah.
Like, and it's great. Like that's a way to translate what you're hearing on the album into that. That's more than just hearing it, but it's interacting with music, which is a really cool thing to do, especially when you're having
that's awesome. And I do get really excited about like ways to interpret the songs a little bit differently live, and also I get really excited about like the different environments to play live music in. So I do think that the next chapter of playing live for me will definitely include a lot of that, a lot of both of those things, like different unique environments, and then also trying to figure out ways to kind of represent each of the instruments on all these kind of very layered songs.
You'll always remember the moment God took her away. For the weight of the world was placed on your shoulders that day. Maybe
working on Atlas 2 right now. Is that going to continue the theme or thematically from Atlas 1, or are you going to try and tackle something new with that series?
Yeah, so Atlas Year 1 is all about like the kind of the origins of the universe. Atlas Year 2, which is what I'm halfway through, that's sort of the that involuntary human development thing I was talking about. Oh, yeah, yeah. And then that will – so I'm in the middle of that, and I'm just about to start the songs for the Enneagram right now. Cool. I've already got a couple of them written. And so I've been doing like a ton of research. I got a chance to do a couple of retreats, one of which was with Father Richard Rohr, who's a really amazing Enneagram teacher, as well as many other things. And so I'm really trying to like just pour all of that knowledge and wisdom into my head about these songs about personality types. And so the goal is for those in 2017 is to complete Atlas Year 2. And then shortly after, I will be working on Atlas Year 3, which will explore the voluntary human development aspect. Right. So the themes of Atlas Year 1 through 3, and I've actually got some other chapters planned, but I've only announced those three. So it'll probably be an ongoing project for me, but I'm waiting for the natural end to it.
Yeah. What is the research process look like for that? So you like kind of create maybe an outline for what you want to communicate over a course of years, but then as you really begin to dive into whatever themes those might be, what does that look like? Like you're going to meet with somebody to learn about personality types. When you were writing about space, like what did that look like as you were exploring space? What is that process?
Yeah, absolutely. So space, for example, I would watch a ton of space documentaries and space travel documentaries and everything I could fill my brain with. And I would watch it a couple months before I would actually write the song. So at the same time I was watching that, I was writing the Light EP. So I always kind of try to research the subject that I'm about to tackle while I'm working on the theme that comes before it. So right now I've been knee deep in Enneagram stuff. And so for me, that was going to those retreats, but also the idea behind each of these nine Enneagram songs is that I'm going to basically conduct these little interviews with different friends of mine that identify as each of these different types, and kind of, so the goal is I want to write each of these songs from their perspective. So they'll still be completely personal to me, especially the one that's my type, which is a type nine. But they will all have that personal, there will still be songs that mean, you know, that come from my heart, but they will hopefully contain the empathy of understanding how another type of personality would experience something. So that's another way I'm really excited. And I'll also invite guests that are of that particular type into like, there's a couple people that play strings that I know that I want them to be recording on their type. So to almost represent like that energy. Guest vocals and stuff like that. So it'll be really fun. But the research part of it is one of my favorite parts of the whole doing like thematic writing, songwriting. It's just really fun to learn a lot more about. And this one in particular, the Enneagram, is such a beautiful tool for understanding yourself and understanding the relationships that are important to you. And also just, I think it's at its best, it's a tool for empathy and understanding the gifts and maybe failures of each type of person.
So a kind of, you know, like a gift for empathy, like are you trying to communicate something to people, like hoping that they would think about something in a particular way when you write about these different themes, or are you just exploring the beauty of them and kind of allowing people to be impacted by that in various ways? Like, do you have a goal for how your music impacts people in the long run?
Yeah, you know, I think the number one goal for me is to write as personally and as honestly as I can. And then I think the outcome for that is I hope that people will find hope and also to feel less alone in whatever they're going through. And I think that, again, art and creativity and sincerity all kind of go hand in hand and hopefully provide that experience for people to be able to kind of look at their life or feel some sense of hope on the horizon in their world. So that's that. When I write, I don't sit down and think like, how can I engineer hope? I've just noticed over the last, you know, decade or so, or make a music, that I that I hope always, no matter how dark the song is, somehow hope always finds a way through in my music. And and I've come to really value that and be excited about that's sort of my I wouldn't say calling, but that's sort of my that's the thing I want to do most with the music.
Cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. I wanted to get to a couple of Twitter questions real quick, and then we'll wrap it up. Lord Danny wants to know, is there any chance that you'll be collaborating with any other artists that we may know soon?
Oh, that's a good question. Nothing. I've got a few things that are tentative coming up in the next couple months, but nothing that I'm able to announce. I'm trying to think. There's got to be something fun to talk about.
No, listen. It's okay. Yes, it's Denise. In case you're wondering, wants to know, which one of your songs could you look at and say has the most personal meaning or significance?
That's a really tough one too, man. I'm going to just be like a cop out answer for all of these, but I'm trying to think what is more recently. I would say, okay, so a song called Touch that I just put out a few, I guess maybe it was late last year, middle of last year. I can't remember. Came out a little while ago as part of my Songs for Each of the Five Senses, and Touch, it was interesting. It turned out to be one of the most like personal songs I've ever written, for sure. But all of them, I mean, like I said, I really, that's my goal, is to never put out anything that I didn't mean with my whole heart, you know? So the sincerity and like authenticity that I don't want to do anything that feels like it goes against that. So hopefully at my best, there's every song that I put out has some of that in there. So
how does that affect, your covers? Like, do you choose songs that, you like maybe for different reasons and then try and sing those or record those in such a way that kind of communicates that, or is that completely random?
It's not random, but I also don't choose them. So what's kind of fun about that project is I will have, like, Grey's Anatomy in particular has asked me to reimagine all these different cover songs, and a lot of them are from the 80s, and I love that process because they're songs that I wouldn't necessarily either know or have any resonance with outside of just kind of knowing what it is. And it was really fun to kind of see how well some of these songs are written. Like, one in particular that I think is really great is the song 500 Miles, which is kind of the original version, is very fun and poppy. And but the lyrics are just, they're so beautiful and they're so sweet. And I never would have noticed that. So getting the chance to kind of dissect these songs and imagine how I would play them and how I would sing them. And that's been really, like, really fun. So I've kind of started these volumes of cover songs that I've been commissioned to create for Grey's Anatomy or for a couple different TV commercials and, a couple other TV shows as well. And so rarely am I actually picking them, 'cause I basically do them only when people are kind enough to ask me to do them. So, and then the other time I'm just writing my own stuff.
Yeah.
Cool. That's awesome.
Devinisms wants to know how you and your wife met.
Oh, awesome. Yeah. So we met, we've been together for a very long time. So right at the beginning of making music, I think it was the end of 1999, we met at, a music festival that I got to play at called Cornerstone.
Nice.
And she came out to see, I think she was with some friends, and we had a couple mutual friends. So she came out to see Sleeping at Last Play, one of our first shows. I guess maybe, I don't know, I was probably doing a bunch of shows at home too, but, one of the early shows. and we ended up talking on, I think AOL Instant Messenger for a very long time. And then she moved to Chicago like 6 or 7 months after that. And then we started dating. So we dated for 10 years before we got married. Wow. And then we've been together now for coming up on 17 years.
Cool.
Wow.
Very cool. Yeah. We'll do one more. TNS Louisa May wants to know who your favorite artist or band is to see live. And she also loves you.
Oh, that's very sweet. I would say one of the best shows I've ever seen in my life was Bjork. She went on her album tour for Vespertine, which I think it's called Vespertine or Vespertine. I'm not sure how to pronounce it, but it's definitely my favorite record of hers. And so I got to see that quite a while ago, and I still consider it the best show I've ever seen.
Awesome.
another band, I mean, Radiohead live is amazing, and it's incredible to see them perform. And who else? I don't go to a lot of shows. I do spend a lot, probably more time than I should in the studio, just hanging, writing songs. So, so I don't get out much, as it turns out.
Yeah.
What's your guilty pleasure? Like the music that you love that you wish no one would know that you love.
Oh man. I think that I'm more into like pop radio than I ever was before, but I don't know if that's a guilty pleasure, cause those songs are really great.
I think pop radio is just getting better.
Yeah, like I feel like the top 40 songs that are, I mean, not all of them, but a lot of them are great songs. So, yeah. But that's,
and it's
not,
amazing, like the amount of like songs that'll start on the alternative stations that will transition into that top 40. Like I feel like more so than ever before the past couple years.
Yeah,
that's been happening.
Yeah, it's true. It's really cool. It's a funny thing that that is happening with music right now, where there is more opportunity and accessibility for every musician that is making music. Anybody that has a computer is able to distribute that music worldwide in seconds, and that is a beautiful thing. And it also creates a lot of extra noise and a lot of static, but it also means that there's less gates and fences between independent musicians and major label musicians, and so it really does like serve the song better, you know?
Yeah.
If this song resonates with enough people and the right people hear it, like it can find its way onto TV or film or radio or whatever, where I feel like there was a very specific channel to make that happen before.
Yeah.
So I think it's a really cool, I think that there's some better stuff on the radio, but I mean, there's always been really good music that gets heard too. I also feel like even back in like the 40s when it was extremely expensive to record music onto, you know, directly onto vinyl, or the 20s or whatever. You can make an argument that that's when the very best of the best musicians were discovered and had that privilege of recording onto, actually getting to record their music was kind of like the natural filtering system of finding the very best talent in the world.
This is my last question. So, do you like Grey's Anatomy?
I do. I do. And I, so it's funny. My wife started watching it from the beginning, and, before I had seen it, I would totally like poke fun at her. And then when I got my first opportunity to have a song in there, of course, I was like totally she would make fun of me like, "See, you made fun of this." Like, well, I hadn't seen it. So I think it's great. And obviously the people that make it are incredible. It's a really special, I mean, this is its 13th season, I believe.
And,
and they have been beyond kind to me, like the whole music team, as well as, Shonda Rhimes specifically, has been just a very wonderful support to me and my music. So,
well, it's got great taste in music.
And, they pick great music. It would also be a crime real quick to not ask you about Twilight. Which I'm sure you won't say those movies suck, but, what was it like writing for, that was, I guess, your first movie that you wrote the song just for that movie,
that's the
right?
First. Yep, I wrote it specifically as a submission for that film, and I had always actually been a fan. I hadn't actually seen the movies before attempting to write, and then I watched all of them in a row and kind of imagined where the story might be going, and so I wrote a submission. But I loved the soundtracks to those movies. They had
do
some
have good
really,
soundtracks.
Really great stuff. Yeah, so I was just like, oh my gosh, it'd be so cool to try my hand at writing something for that, and I knew that the characters were going to, you know, eventually get married, and I was like, okay, love song. I'm going to try to write a love song. And but man, I will say that like the fans of Twilight are some of the most wonderful and like passionate people. Like I always joke around that if I could feel as much passion about anything as they do about Twilight, even half the amount, I'd be set for life.
Like, that's awesome.
It's a really special thing. But I think anything that can bring people together and create community, but also to again, like I said, to make people feel less alone. Like that's a really beautiful and important thing. So, and I definitely saw firsthand that Twilight has done that for a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, man, thank you so much for joining. You're just the nicest guy. You write the music that gives everyone the feels, and
all the feels.
It is all that we could ask for. So please keep making music that makes people think, because We need more of that. I'd love to end the episode by playing one of your new songs off the Atlas too. Which one would you not mind us playing?
Oh, you can play whatever you like.
Wow. Well, which one would you say, man, this would really put a good stamp on the end of the
oh, podcast. Man. Well, I usually like the saddest ones possible. So
likewise,
I don't know if you want to end on that note, but,
sure. Why not?
What was last song came out, was Fear. So don't probably play that one.
Okay.
How about that Sorrow? Sorrow. Do Sorrow, yeah.
Sorrow it is. This is Sorrow by Sleeping At Last. They can still subscribe to the Vinyl 2, right? Or yep. Not Vinyl 2, I'm sorry. Atlas 2.
I just went with that. I was like, yep, for sure.
Yeah, that Vinyl 2, that's a great idea.
You can still subscribe to Atlas 2.
And I look forward to starting our West Wing podcast together. It'll be great.
Absolutely. Great. Absolutely.
Here's Sorrow.
It feels like falling. It feels like rain, like losing my balance again and again. It once was so easy, breathe out at the foot of this mountain. I only see clouds. I feel out of focus, or at least indisposed. Is this strange when the pattern inside me takes hold? Each brave step forward I take, three steps behind. It's mind over matter, matter over mine. Slowly, then all at once, a single loose thread, and it all comes undone. A shadow appears, the car.